I hope for you that the summer has moments beautiful and set apart enough from the ordinary run of days to sting you. Sting you, yes. If you have a favorite summer getaway, and you got away, or you will, I hope that last night under the stars, that last look over the lake, I hope it is incomparable and fulfilling, and that it carries a sting in it. And I know we all can't get away, if not from the town, from our children, or other duties. Still, summer passes so swiftly. These precious days hang like ripe fruit from the tree of life. I hope you have tasted the juice of it, a summer shower coming down on you, maybe getting you wet, maybe not. The shouts of shoeless children's glee. I hope you might have experienced the moon's kiss when the evening air was so perfect your skin wanted to shout for joy just to be touched by it. And I hope also that there comes some time from these things a sting. Awareness brings the sting. This does not last. Where are all things going? What is my life? I hope for you that you have felt questions like those this summer. Oftentimes, ordinary religion does not help us to live into sharp, passionate awareness, to live with feeling. Religion sometimes doesn't help very much in that area, at least for some people, to live, as the Italians might say, con affetto. I want to invite you today to experience again, as I bet you do every Sunday and maybe every day for some, to experience your intuition that Christian faith is not ideas and beliefs in your head. It is not even certain values dearly cherished and stated, but it is deep water springing up to life, passionate and bold, compassionate, hopeful, loving, honest. So if there are brambles in the way of that wellhead, we're going to have to clear them out of the way. And oftentimes those brambles have been put there by what I call ordinary religion. We're going to have a fight with ordinary religion right now. And so I ask you to consider Salma. This summer, most mainline churches, Protestant and Catholic alike, are skipping through 1 Kings according to the lectionary. Now, you probably know what that is. I'll share with you. Pleased to learn that your pastor doesn't cause you to walk on that pound, through that pound every week, every year. But the lectionary is a cycle of prescribed readings. It's designed to give a broad exposure to the Bible, provided you come to church worship every Sunday for 3 years. However, lectionary listeners we'll hear only two stories about Solomon in 3 years. Only two. One, you've just heard it, how in a dream the newly crowned king prays not for power or wealth or other worldly gifts, but for wisdom. And the other story that one would hear from the lectionary is an eloquent prayer that Solomon offers at the dedication of the temple. That's it. So here are two hero stories of the king under whose rule Israel did indeed find wealth and power flowing to the little land. Her armies forced her enemies to bend their borders back and to pay tribute. Great potentates paid state visits. A great temple to Yahweh was erected. Solomon, you could say, was Israel's summer. But if you only knew these two stories, well, If you only knew these two stories of Solomon, that would be summer without the sting. The seriousness would be missing. And it's not the whole story. The Bible's account of Solomon is much more serious. Many stories are told. Many tell of sorrow, not summer. How he made slaves out of the resident aliens, the undocumented workers of his day, in order to build that temple on the cheap. How he married women from every land he could get his hands on. 700, the story says. That's what it says. And how he built idols to every single god those women worshipped all around Jerusalem. And then how he mistreated his commanders so that on the day of his death they raised a coup and his kingdom, or the kingdom, was destroyed in that very season of his death. The Bible is really peculiar. More than any national lore of which I am aware, the Bible sings exuberantly of its heroes, but tells their tragic tales too. It's a kind of a warning against adoration. Imagine an American pantheon in which the main story about George Washington and Thomas Jefferson included impassioned judgment for their heartlessness in holding women and men as slaves. That would sound like the Bible if it were told that way. But we Americans would be a completely different kind of people if we could think like that together. I don't just mean here and there in pockets. I mean together, the way Israel thinks together about their heroes. By contrast, when you hear happy hero stories only, what happens? What happens when the church reads its Bible so sparingly that only the summer of Solomon is told? What happens when a nation tucks its bloody rags of history under its fine hat so that we come to know only Solomon the wise, Solomon the prayerful, only Thomas the incomparable, George the liberator? What happens? I would say this. From a false past comes false hope and a false future. It's really serious business to get the stories right. There comes from false heroes a dream of a day which is summertime all the time. How did one of our presidents put it? Morning in America. A new day dawning. Or on the religious side, we get Jesus, Jesus, coming to destroy the unbelievers and rule in perfection forever in bliss for us. These are not idle tales. They are told, we hear these slogans, they're really out there. They promise life at no cost, no sting, no awareness, no growth. Many of our people in this land are caught in fantasies like these. Demonizing them we will not do, but it's important to see it. Many are caught in the web of such fantasies. It is not the Word of God. This is not the gospel. This is what religion in human hands looks like. It's frantic. It's cruel often. It's a religion that you may feel ashamed to be associated with sometimes. I have certainly felt that. It's a religion for which you may find it hard to speak in public or in a public way. You may feel tongue-tied. We had that song a little while ago, "Oh, speak to me that I may speak." Well, let us go a little deeper into the problem that we face with ordinary religion. Every religion has a version of ordinary religion. The critique against Christianity is because we're Christians, and we should have this critique. Ordinary religion cuts the essence of its wisdom in half and only teaches and preaches the half that the ego wants to hear. That's what's going on. It tells of the soul saved or the soul's damned. As if there's no continuing process of growth possible or necessary for a soul to become mature over time. It tells of absolute truths, of evil and good nations, condemning whole religions and whole nations with one word, evil. This binary worldview is always based in the law, as if it has completely plugged its ears from the gospel texts themselves, which are not based in law. You know, if Jesus saw the city of moral majoritarians who have set themselves apart from humanity, he would weep. He would weep as he did outside Jerusalem, saying, "Would that even today you knew the things that make for peace." But ordinary religion, oddly enough, is not actually a religious problem as such. It's an expression of an ego problem. It's an obsessive need to control the future. We all have this need. We all obsess about it in various ways. Ordinary religion feeds that egoistic desire to control God, to control the future. America as a whole, and maybe every powerful nation, has this disease. Paul Tillich called it forwardism. I'm going to use that word several times. Forwardism. Forwardism is the attitude, the belief, that the great, great accomplishment necessary is just over there after I do this. And then the wonderful day will arrive. It leads men like Solomon to overreach in women and in war. In the spirit of forwardism, we Americans let our former president and his handlers pipe us into tragically endless war in the Middle East. A war that was dreamed up in utopian, forwardist hopes of salvation from evildoers. But it is also forwardism to believe that science will solve every fundamental problem we face and will come to understand everything about the biology of humanity and consciousness, provided we can get rid of the superstitious, as the new atheists claim. It is forwardism to trust that laws can save us, old ones or new ones, or the right leader can save us. That's forwardism, that he, she can bring the day of righteousness and prosperity, provided we can suppress the other party. It is forwardism, perhaps, that is causing Americans to get completely stuck on this healthcare matter, so that we cannot even see that while fire protection and police protection are rights, that protection of the body is not deemed a right in this society. I think it's forwardism because it shares in the same basic fear, which is I need to control what is mine, mine, mine. You know, we could mine this theme all morning, but it's getting stuffy. Let's get some air. If we read wisely, hero stories need not feed our appetite for control. They can nourish our mind and our heart in a sweet and effective way. Consider Solomon. I have no idea whether it's so, whether it really happened, that he had a dream in which he believed or felt that he was praying to God and asking for wisdom. I don't know whether that's so. It doesn't really matter. I wouldn't be surprised, incidentally, if Obama had had a dream in which he humbly confessed recently to his God that he had no idea how to govern this, your great people. Maybe Solomon did too. Whether he was so minded or not, the fact is that 3,000 years of telling that story has surely moved the hearts and minds of God's people. Here you are seeing it. the depth of our religious tradition is holding high for all to see that a person in power ought not ask for more power or for wealth, but for wisdom to discern good from evil. Why, just last Thursday, did you catch this on the news? We heard an up-to-date version of this story. It was pretty exciting, I thought. America's newest Supreme Court justice was at an affair at the White House, not her swearing in, and she publicly asked, quote, that all Americans wish me divine guidance and wisdom in administering my new office. Well, go with God, Sonia Solomon Sotomayor. We really can read these stories for wisdom's sake without making false hopes from false heroes. But I want to step back into the bright air, a level higher. What is a hero, really? How do you recognize a hero? Isn't it this? Some bright, sharply defined value already shining in your heart, in your mind, falls like a ray on the hero. And you feel excited and passionate because what you have been caring about, perhaps shadowed and unknown to some extent, but you've been caring about this in your depths, and suddenly you see it raised up in human form so clear. In other words, you can only see a hero because you have hero light inside you. Put it another way, hero stories from history and legend are working like a mirror. You are recognizing a part of yourself in the hero story, the royal one, the wise one, the passionate one, the strong one. These are essentially you. 2 centuries ago, in the great mind of the poet Goethe, these ideas were captured with especial clarity, leading from I to I am. He wrote in a quatrain, "Were the eye not of the sun, how could we behold the light? If God's sight and ours were not as one, how could his work enchant our sight?" So this is half of the hero's tale, when we tell it right. And the other half awaits us. When we read well, we see that the hero's feet are like ours, clay. Just as the heroes reveal within us our passion and our capacities, so also their weakness and their failure is showing if we read well. Solomon's sorrow is there. Solomon's error is there to read. Just like yours and mine, you have to forget the lectionary. It won't help you. Such a peculiar whole is here. You and they, the heroes, are exalted, precious, crowned in the eye of God. Yes, and from the letter of James, you are amissed. Thus thou art. Unto dust thou shalt return, crushed with doubts and with grievous memories, every one of us, bent by every wind, and like the summer, soon gone. It's the sting. You are rose and thorn, run down and righteous, and if not both, then neither. Who can live like this? One answer is, Christians are called to live like this. It's enough, you know, to make us turn in awe to pray, O God, who can govern this your great people or this your great person? Who can govern? Give therefore to me an understanding mind able to discern good from evil. Right here is where you can feel and exercise the essential practice of Christian faith. Hear its distinctive voice. It's calling your name. You, O Christian, like a hero, are called to govern. First yourself in the light of Christ. Then also to govern all those whom you are given to govern. Children, certainly. Your household, your spouse, those who work for you, and so forth. You are called to lead others. That's how we might hear that better. To lead others who are given to you. And you are called to learn from everyone. Everything, really. What is this light of Christ? You see it in Jesus. It is the opposite of forwardism's grasping fear. It is a passionate acceptance of what is coming to me now. The rose and its thorn, our summer and its end. I want to call this a passion for the partial. In Jesus, you see no striving to finish, no concern to know the right people, no anxiety to orchestrate right politics, no climb up any ladder except the cross. He did not finish best in show. Not the best philosopher. Not the best orator. Not the best doctor, and in the world's point of view, not the best man. He allowed himself to die, seen by virtually everyone as a common criminal. Yet in his eye, he was always seeing a holy world. Always a holy world, even as the nails go in the wrist. A world where not just humans, these are Wendell Berry's words, not just humans, but all creatures live by participating in the life of God. All creatures by partaking of God's Spirit. If Jesus, the essentially human one, is your hero, oh, are you blessed. For this bright, sharp love for what is least and lowest and lost, this love already showing in you, already shining fearlessly in your heart and mind, for, to turn Goethe's phrase just a little bit, were your eye not of the sun, how could you behold his light? The Christian passion for the partial, not the final, but the partial, can fire and inspire fierce dedication to correct oppression. Like that you've heard of in Katie's story today. For you can be moved to act, not worrying about whether you will succeed. I heard her story say she didn't succeed at first and pressed on. One who has a passion for the partial can always press on because love is the moment or the movement, not success. After the angry burnout, love is still patient and kind. Moreover, the Christian passion for the partial funds an edgeless compassion for yourself and for all. As you run this human race, not so much running forward as inward, finding yourself deeper in the grace of God, ever more willing to give what is asked or needed and to receive what is given, careless of earthly ends, not anxious to win, not afraid to let go at the right time. You are just like your master, the last hero, really. The one who comes not to win, but to win you to this way of peace, aware of summer and its sting, through your passion for the partial. Amen.